at scale, you know, when, because we all are building companies to scale for the most part, you know, misalignment becomes the most expensive risk. Growth will only amplify the cracks. Your mission, your partners, your customers, they all have to be pulling kind of in the same direction.
Welcome back to the Breakout CEO Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Holman. Very glad to be with you again today, talking with smart people like Paul Roberts from Good Bites. Paul, so glad to have you on the show.
Great to be here, Jeff. You know, watched a couple of the episodes. Love the conversation. Excited to be here.
Well, the conversation comes from the guests. I mean, we get all these great insights, and so we're lucky to have you as we've had other guests that have done really cool stuff. So thank you.
Appreciate that.
Yeah. So you've done, I mean, speaking of doing stuff, we might as well just jump right into that, right? You've done a few things, a few successful things that led up to your current thing. We'll get a few details on each of those and get down to some breakout moments here. But tell me first, you know, we talked a little bit in our icebreaker questions about family and about how you like to talk with your kids and your spouse about the things going on in the business. I know some people who do that, some people who are very much open at home about business. Maybe sometimes business is happening in the home. Like, how does that impact the way that you think about business, where you've got these kids and wife and everybody is kind of, I don't know if they're involved, but they're involved, right?
Yeah, they're involved because, again, where I just think as executives, CEOs, founders, this is unfortunately a 24/7 job most of the time. So you do take a lot of it. You do wear a lot of it on your shoulders all the time. Things are good. You know, things are bad. I think one of the biggest challenges is making sure that that doesn't bleed into the day-to-day at home. While you're talking about business, I try personally to keep it as almost teaching moments for the kids of, you know, this is how you can be an entrepreneur. This is what entrepreneurs do. This is what CEOs do. And I think, you know, to keep it in the house is more from that teaching moment. You know, mm-hmm. I try it, like, you know, my wife will realize I'm having a tough day. She's like, all right, let it go. You know, tomorrow's a new day. Like, let's have fun as a family and kind of put that aside.
Yeah. Yeah. And that can be hard to do. I mean, because you said, we are in this all day, every day. And, you know, I have my own small business, but talking with the CEOs that I work with in other businesses, like it's, there's a lot on your shoulders and there's not always a lot of, there aren't a lot of resources necessarily to turn to offload that. Right. So you have to kind of put it away for the evening. It comes back out the next day and it's still there. Like, how do you manage the stresses and, you know, maybe release the pressures of being a CEO?
Well, one thing I've learned is that you have to really focus on the variables you can control. Mm-hmm. There's so much of it that's out of our control. You know, I can't fly over to India and sit at the desk of some of the developers and say, move faster.
Yeah.
You know, it's things are going to happen as they happen. I wake up every morning with a to-do list to try to impact the business ways that I personally can, and try to let people that I trust and have put in those positions to do their job. You know, are there times where we need to kind of have a conversation of, okay, we need to speed things up. We need to do things better, of course. But I personally look at it as, you know, maintaining my sanity by looking at the variables I can personally put my finger on and say, okay, I can help the company grow by doing this. I can help the company scale by doing that. If I just sat all day, you know, for 18 hours a day and looked at every single little nuance of what's going right, what's going wrong, I think I would lose my mind.
Yeah. Well, so have you put other people in place to take care of those things that you don't have control over? Like, other people can worry about that? Or is it just something that, you know, when the time comes and the situation is right, you'll be able to take care of it? How do you, because putting that off helps for now, but a lot of times those things are still there tomorrow, right?
It's not so much of putting it off. I always equate a CEO as a great bench coach. You might not be out there hitting the final shot. You might not throw the touchdown or take the last shot of the game, but you put that person there. You gave them the playbook. You gave them all the tools and resources they needed to be successful. You know, I would always tell people, I a lot of times the engineers, the data scientists, I don't really always understand everything they're saying. But you try to hire the best and the brightest who do know what they're doing, who do understand all those nuances. So that's kind of helpful where, you know, I can't write certain code. I can't design certain algorithms, but you have those people who can, and you put your trust in them, which is a big part of it. You're trusted that you have the right pieces, and you have to very quickly assess if you don't to make sure you get those right pieces. So for me, that's kind of how I look at it, that I don't need to be the shining star, nor am I most times in an organization. It's, you know, I just have the playbook and the resources to put the right people out on the field.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to hear about who the right people are and what the team looks like that are good bites. But before we do that, what give us a flavor of some of the mileposts from your career that led up to starting Good Bites.
Yeah. I've been a serial entrepreneur since, you know, my early 20s. And I was joking with somebody the other day, you bat 300 in baseball, you get into the Hall of Fame. I've probably done just around that, successful startups. You know, I've raised over $130 million over the last 10 years for companies that I helmed. I did a SPAC during the SPAC boom. We raised a little over $100 million for that SPAC. You know, for me, it was always, how do you find, you know, real problems to solve that are going to have scalability? And, you know, we've done some unique things around data science and machine learning. And with Goodbite, the whole focus is how do you combine everyday behavior with doing well? So our motto is, you know, eat well, do good. So, you know, we're building a food delivery platform that gives back with every order. This is a something that I'm not reinventing food delivery. I'm not going to reinvent charity. But if we can combine the two of them into a very seamless, scalable platform, you know, we could have real impact and obviously help people along the way.
Yeah, you're putting a Paul Roberts stamp on your own business model. Well, so from those experiences pre Good Bites, what are a couple of the lessons that you picked up that you've been able to now apply as the CEO of Good Bites?
Where do I start?
the thousands, the daily lessons, right?
Yeah. You know,
which ones stand out to you though?
Sure. Like at scale, you know, because we all are building companies to scale for the most part, you know, misalignment becomes the most expensive risk. If you early on we rush. And sometimes things get misaligned, things get done improperly. And then as you start to scale, it really becomes expensive.
Are you talking stuff like having the wrong tech stack? Are you talking about like team and culture? Are you talking about pricing? Or I mean, or is it just any of those?
All the above. And I've kind of dealt with all of those where, you know, hey, one company, we decided, hey, let's use Erlang, this you know, unique language, and great. Mm-hmm. So we code our first iteration in Erlang, and I realized there's about 45 Erlang developers across the entire United States. I just happened to meet a really good one day one, you know, in New York City. So now all of a sudden he's like, well, I would have probably suggested we don't use Erlang. I said, that would have been nicer to hear earlier. And then hiring, like I mentioned earlier, you know, everybody looks good on a resume in an interview. A lot of times it's, you know, you have to cut your losses quickly and move on. So all of the things you mentioned, pricing models, a lot of times when you build a product or you build a company, you have a certain pricing model in your mind. But then once you go to test the market, it completely changes. So I think there's all of those. You have to be somewhat flexible, but also giving yourself an off ramp as you scale. Because I think if you lock yourself into that code, if you lock yourself into a certain employee or pricing, you know, you could find yourself in a very, very tough spot when you start to scale up. You know, I've seen teams where, you know, one person, I would always joke, you know, who's got the keys to the elevator? If it's only one person, we're in trouble. You know, we have to have distributed risk within the organization.
As you're saying this, it makes me think of some experiences I've seen with clients where, you know, sometimes these early, you know, first, second, third time CEOs, they go out and they learn all these lessons.
Yep.
And then they kind of pull back. They're like, man, I can't take this anymore. I gotta take less risk. Or whatever. Every CEO who's started companies has been through these lessons in one form or another. Has going through these lessons made you, you know, in some aspects more cautious how you approach things? Has it made you more bold? Has it just made you smarter? Like, how would you characterize what you've taken away from the lessons?
Yeah, you know, I think what I've learned over the last, you know, few decades, it's you can't learn in business school. You only can learn it by doing it. So I you know, you wore the black eyes, you did the thing, you lost the money, you scaled the company, you won. You know, all these different things come from experience. So being more bold or more cautious, I don't think I necessarily lean one way or the other. It's just you see where a lot of the landmines are before they come up on the journey, if that makes sense.
Yep.
And again, you realize things where, a big thing I believe in is try not to make the same mistakes twice. Because, as a CEO, it's very, very painful. So if I made it a company ago or two companies ago or a different fundraising event, you try not to make it again. But I think that it's that knowledge of being through that experience that can afford you the ability to be a little more bold, because oddly enough, you're a little more cautious in certain areas because you've been there. You realize not to make that mistake again.
I talk to clients about and friends and everybody, business owners, about seeing around corners that you haven't you haven't seen around before, right? And acting like a second time founder when you're really a first time founder, and trying to leverage those things. How do you? So clearly, when you've been through a situation and you've seen the results of that, you know, okay, next time I'm going to do the same thing, or I'm not going to do the same thing. How has that influenced your ability to make decisions about corners that you haven't seen around yet, that you haven't actually experienced?
I think you just start to trust your instincts faster. You don't need the perfect information. You don't need the perfect data. You'll get the data. I think you just need the right signal or enough of a signal to move with conviction, because you almost have that third, let's say, you have a sense, you have something that's telling you, okay, I have a general idea what's around that corner, and I've done this before. I've peeked around strange corners in business It's not the end of the world. We've gotten out of it. You just try not to ever have that fatal blow, I guess.
I love that phrase. I haven't heard anybody say it that way. Peeked around strange corners. So
once it came out, I said, wait a second, I have to clarify this a little bit.
Oh no, I didn't take it in any other way. That, like, I think as a business owner, you are peeking around a lot of strange, unfamiliar territory, and you're just like, never been over that hill.
I'm speaking to somebody this morning and they're like, well, how much experience you have in the food restaurant industry? I said, zero.
Yeah.
But I understand it's a marketplace. I have supply, demand. I have these mechanisms that I do understand very well from other companies I've started. So it's, you just have to kind of insert, food delivery versus websites or, different things in my mind that I could easily get my head around. So yes, it is a blind spot. It is peeking around a corner, but at the end of the day, it's a pretty fundamental business.
So when you made the transition from earlier business into Good Bites, well, tell us first, give us the overview of Good Bites, give us your elevator pitch for that.
Yeah. Very similar to every food delivery app you've ever used, DoorDash, Grubhub, Seamless, et cetera. No big difference there. The main difference is that when you go to place an order, we're going to give you the opportunity to select a charity you want to support. So today we have a handful of national charities like Make-A-Wish, No Kid Hungry, a lot of local charities. We're very focused on the college campuses because most Greek organizations, student organizations, they have to support a charity every semester. Mm. They're also ordering food at a rate significantly higher than your average consumer. A lot of times,
not my wife.
A lot of times the students are using mom and dad's credit card. It's almost funny, it's monopoly money to them. So what we're doing is, rebuilding today a food delivery marketplace with restaurants and consumers and charities in the middle. So we're introducing, really good behavior, charity behavior every single day for these college students who, when they're ordering their plier bowl or their tacos, they're also delivering $2 to a charity that really has an impact.
Oh, nice. Well, I guess I should clarify. My wife does a lot of Instacart for the family. I guess not as much of the DoorDash type stuff, Good Bites stuff, if that's what it
fair.
Is. Well, I want to hear about the charity aspect of it, but I want to go back just for a second to what we were talking about and kind of link the prior experience to starting Good Bites, because I'm really curious. Did you have experience in the business? I think you just said not a lot of experience in the food business, but what kind of things did you bring from your past experiences to say, yeah, this is where I'm going to go. This is what I want to do. And I've got a few skills that I can bring to this.
So a prior company that I built was a programmatic advertising company. So we took a tremendous amount of websites, publishers, connected TV apps, and we connected them to advertisers. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's a very similar marketplace where we're connecting supply and demand. If you just insert, the websites and the apps with the consumers and the advertisers with restaurants, we're just basically creating pipes. If I tried to build, Goodbite 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it would have cost $50 to $100 million. But today, you have these point of sale systems. Everybody has an API integration. Everybody's connected.
Yeah.
So for us, we're basically acting as a middle layer between all these different, all these different delivery services, all these different restaurants, all these different POS systems, all of these different charities. And we're giving the consumer a nice, easy front end to go in and basically order food and feel good about it. So, like I said, if I tried to do this and, I've looked at, spent countless hours reading through the public filings of, these other large marketplaces and the amount of money they spent to build driver networks and connectivity between all the restaurants, it was hundreds of millions of dollars. But now that they've done that, we could build on top of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So the cost of entry is not nearly as high. So you're not the first mover in the market, right? There are other people who have existed. Is there some hesitancy when you're saying to yourself, okay, these guys have been in the market for a while. They've established, they've built the infrastructure too, which you can leverage, but should we really go up against some of these people? Is this where we really want to be?
One of the first people I called is a gentleman who's invested alongside me in numerous ventures. And I said, I'm going to rebuild DoorDash and Grubhub, but do it right. And he laughed and he said, you're just crazy enough to do this, aren't you? I said, yeah. And I said to him, the entire angle right now, if you look at the behavior of the consumers, they're getting incredibly frustrated with the fees that they're paying. The restaurants are being charged anywhere from 15 to 30% mm-hmm. by these platforms. And if you speak to a restaurant owner, I know a lot of restaurant owners here in New York, they say my margin's not 25%.
But the platforms want to take that entire margin.
Correct. So now what happens, the consumer gets hurt because that restaurant owner has to increase his prices across the board on his menu anytime somebody orders through one of these apps.
Yeah.
Just to cover the fee. And there's other issues like these platforms don't share any of the consumer data with the restaurants. So a good friend of mine, he's got, six restaurants here in New York. He said, I'm basically a ghost kitchen for these platforms.
Yeah.
The consumer comes on, they see me, they order the food. A driver shows up with a number. I match the number to the tag. I give them the food and off they go. I have no connection with my consumer. So I think you're seeing a lot of, I don't want to say use the word regret because obviously they're generating a lot of revenue, but I think the business model is causing a lot of angst with restaurants.
Yeah. Workers. I mean, certainly there's got to be tension, right? Somebody who's built a brick and mortar restaurant has seats to fill and staff right. on site. All of a sudden they're balancing the normal operating costs with the ghost kitchen model. Right. It also makes me think because I've talked a lot of guests recently for whatever reason, I've brought up the book Unreasonable Hospitality. And the way you mentioned it just made me think of that. How do you build unreasonable hospitality for a consumer market that you don't actually have the data for and don't even interact with? Like that's you're missing out at one of the maybe most fulfilling parts of a business, right? Building the community around that restaurant.
Just a quick note about our guests. I host the Breakout CEO podcast to share behind-the-scenes insights from scaling businesses. As an attorney, I see the real challenges leaders face long before success becomes public. But client stories have to stay confidential, so we invite guest CEOs to share their own moments of struggle and success. I'm so grateful to our guests and my team at Intellectual Strategies for making this show possible. Now, let's get back to the show.
And Jeff, I think you just hit the nail on it. A big part for us connecting the consumer, the restaurant with a charity. So everyone feels part of something bigger than just the transaction.
Yeah.
That order starts to feel personal. We give the charity, you order your meal, your pizza comes, you know, 30 minutes later, you're getting a text message from the charity thanking you and explaining what your $2 actually means to that charity, where somebody like No Kid Hungry, it feeds, you know, 5 to 10 kids.
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden you're eating your meal, it has such a greater impact. And then we're hoping that this ties back to the restaurant, the meal. It's no longer, hey, I just ordered from this massive, you know, conglomerate. It right. actually has an impact. The restaurant's a part of that. The restaurant owner can feel good about that as well.
And there's a whole side of the business with the nonprofit, right? Like I sat on the board of a nonprofit here in Utah called Friends for Sight. They would screen kids at a certain age for amblyopia or you know what turns into lazy eye, and if you catch it, you can correct it. If you don't, you can't. At least not as easily. I'm not sure if you can correct it or not totally, but they did this, and I remember them talking. This was back before, I don't know, this was maybe 12 years ago, and they were talking about how they were one of, I think, two or three charities who were approved to be on the DMV renewal forms, and you could check the box, add a dollar, add $2, whatever it was, and how that, even though it was such a small amount, that was a huge part of their operating budget because it worked, right? And they had access to it, and other people probably would have loved to have the same access. I'm not sure how that worked politically, but you know, so you're really giving an avenue to the, I mean, it from a consumer standpoint, I think it'd be easy to say, oh gosh, you know, I'm making a little contribution. Yeah, I feel good. But to the nonprofit, some of these programs that really give them exposure can create an entire, you know, operating budget for them that wasn't there before, right?
Yeah, it's huge. And you're right. We're making very similar to the license plate idea. It's how do you make giving effortless, you know, build it into everyday actions. And then suddenly those small gestures, like you said, could be one of the biggest, you know, donation channels that these nonprofits see.
Yeah.
What a lot of the charities struggle with also is in America, we're typically giving, you know, about 70 to 80% of donors give one time and don't give again to a charity. So it's hard for them to stay engaged. And I think that's one thing we're trying to address where, you know, after a while, the charities will say to us, well, how many more pleas or how many more mailings, how many more emails or postcards can we send? Now, all of a sudden, it's okay. We know, you know, Paul and, you know, he's got three boys. They're playing a lot of sports. His wife, we're always running around. We order food maybe a few times a week. I could have a real impact without really doing anything more than I was already doing.
Yeah.
And then it gives the charity a great opportunity then to engage with that audience in a very positive way. They're not calling, they're not asking for your credit card number anymore to, you know, Jeff, we want you to run another 5K. It's thank you for your donation. It's a very positive, net positive, you know, interaction with the person who donated the money.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Creating those recurring touch points that I don't know if there's a phrase for it, but there's a marketing phrase for it, right? I went to recurring revenue, and what's the analogous for recurring touch points for a nonprofit, but it's probably just brand exposure, right?
Yeah. It's engagement also. It's, you know, and the audience we're targeting, that college student, is such a valuable audience for charities, especially as they're coming out of, you know, the education side of the world into the what's called making money side of the world.
Yeah.
You know, so they're looking for, okay, where do I have a higher purpose here? Where can I help make an impact? So they're also learning about charities through Good Bite that they might not have already known about.
Well, so Paul, what does Good Bite look like today? Like what markets are you in? What does your team look like? Things like that.
Yeah. So we're currently in beta at one university. We'll be at 50 universities, hopefully by the end of March. We have a goal to be at 100 campuses next year. Hopefully we're going to be somewhere in the neighborhood north of maybe 500,000 orders per month, which will equate to about $1 million donated per month.
Wow.
We have 208 college ambassadors, university ambassadors across the U.S., ranging from, you know, big SEC schools, Big Ten, UCLA, State University of New York system. We have students. Because they're the ones who honestly really care, and they're the ones who are getting this, you know, really engagement on campus. So they're the ones talking to their fellow students of, you know, I see you order your coffee every single day to class. You know, use Good Bite now rather than this other platform. We're going to get $2 to a local food bank or, you know, a woman's shelter here in town.
Yeah.
I don't, and I've said this numerous times publicly, I don't want to have a massive, you know, 300-400 person company. I think so much can be done with AI, and so much can be done with, you know, repeated tasks with AI, which is great. That, you know, maybe another podcast for another day on how AI is really changing the workforce, but it's been something else for me personally.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, so as you've been building this, as you've been putting the ambassadors in place, as you've been rolling out the beta at the university, like what's been working well?
It's keeping it simple, not overcomplicating it. It's, you know, this is a food delivery platform. It's going to save the restaurants money. It's going to help students donate money that you know, to a charity that cares, and it helps the charities see that repeatable donation and also engagement from a very valuable audience in the college students. So all three parties have benefited so far from GoodBite. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter now of how quickly we can scale it across the country to every campus. And then the goal is within 24 months to be nationally every city, every state.
Yeah, very cool. I love the goals. What's an area where you've run into maybe unexpected obstacles that you thought, oh, this will be, you know, we'll just put, you know, you put these things in place, then everything starts rolling from there. And you're like, wait a second, there's another thing I got to deal with. What have you had to deal with as you've done this?
I think the biggest one we've had to overcome is a lot of these bigger, you know, platforms dangle some incentives and get an exclusivity. So restaurants will only be on one platform. So we've had to kind of check, you know, think of creative ways to do that. We've worked with a lot of universities in conversation to be part of their meal plan, different things like that. But that was one we didn't see. You know, and anytime you're going to develop a market, you always have to quickly figure out the hard side of the market.
Yeah.
Charities, every single charity we speak to says yes. They want to engage with donors. They want more donations. The students love the idea. They can't stand the fees. They can't stand the fact that, you know, there's you know, no other way really. It's challenging on campus to raise donations. So this helps them. Restaurant owners enjoy it because they're paying less money and they could actually feel good. You know, they're helping their community. So that was the biggest thing we came up against, was that some of these other platforms require the restaurants to sign, you know, either short-term or long-term exclusivity deals.
Hmm. That seems, I'm surprised that they would do that. I mean, I guess I'm, as I think about it, Coke and Pepsi, you don't find them at the same spots very often, right? And so a lot of them, I think, either cost structure-wise, they've created exclusivity, or maybe they've got contracts, I'm not sure. But I guess I'm a little surprised that there's exclusivity. What's the incentive of the restaurants to have that exclusivity? Better, like a better terms, better pricing, better?
Exactly. They'll typically tell them, hey, you know what, your contract's 30%. Commission, you know, we'll do, you know, 20% commission if you give us an exclusivity for 6 months. You know, don't want our competitors' apps.
Interesting. And that's, if that's the difference between making some profit versus making no profit, then I guess why not do it, right? It's a
100%.
Until you see the competition out there. Well, so when you've approached these restaurants, whether they've got the exclusivity or not, you're talking to them one at a time, I assume, right? Or
it's really the student ambassadors. So that's the interesting part of our model, is we, you know, we'll have anywhere from 2 to 15 ambassadors per campus. And one of the first things we do is build out a list of all the restaurants in the area, assign that to the student ambassadors. They'll go in, hey, I'm Paul from, from student government here at the university. We'd like to start raising money for the local food bank and this national charity. We're going to do that by ordering more food from you. And the way that we're going to order that food is through a platform called GoodBite. There's no cost to you as a restaurant. You're actually going to pay less commission than you do currently with these other platforms. The $2 donation comes from GoodBite, not from the consumer or the restaurant. And we connect it, you know, relatively seamless into their POS system. It takes about 15 minutes to set up. And you know, the students can start ordering food that day.
Oh, nice. So
we try to make it, you know, restaurant owners, you know, you walk in, they have a huge rush, you know, they're going to deliver at the back door, the phone's ringing, you have to be very, very quick, very direct. Here's what we do. Here's how we do it. We'd love to have you on board. If not, you know, we'll come back in a month. Hopefully you have time then.
Or when your exclusivity is done.
Either or.
Yeah. When you've, How do you manage the charity side of it? Because I could see a lot of charities, like you said, everyone says yes if you ask them. If I were using the platform, I'd go on the platform, I'd order my food at the local, you know, whatever restaurant.
Sure.
And do I have then, like, I select my favorite and it just pops up my favorite charity each time? Or do I have to select from a list of 50 charities in the area? How does that work?
Yeah, a couple different ways. So one is we can give a group like a hard coded link for people to download or use the website where it'll be a specific charity. They could always go back and change the charity if they want. We also built in like an impact calculator, so you could actually see how much you've donated over time. But any given time, you could always go back and change your charity. Most times when you log in, depending on the campus, you're going to have an option of about 8 charities. So it'll be a mix of national charities and local charities. But, you know, we use Charity Navigator on the back end to verify the legitimacy of the charity. So we only, you know, work with 8+ charities. And if there's a nonprofit that wants to get involved, we also have a section on our site where they can email us and say, hey, we'd love to be listed. We give them their own link to share with their audience.
Okay.
You know, please use Good Bite to order your food. Every time you order, so you know, we're going to basically get $2. So we tried to make the UI and the experience for the consumer pretty painless. They select their charity one time, and then they'll always see it in their receipt. But if they want to change it, they could always get into their account, just like a credit card or a delivery address, and just change it.
Yeah. What kind of adoption trends are you seeing? Are you seeing that this is, I mean, nonprofits say yes, restaurants who are not in exclusivity, they probably just say yes because, you know, why not add another channel to their what they're doing, right? Like, what about the consumers in this beta market that you're in? Is adoption easy because you're kind of leveraging network effects, or have you seen some bumps trying to get to adoption?
It's 100% network effect. So what we see is when we onboard a new ambassador who's, let's say, you know, the captain of the lacrosse team or, you know, the head of philanthropy for the sorority, mm-hmm. we immediately see an additional, you know, 400 or 500 users immediately. And then okay. it slowly fans out. Because what we do is we reinforce the messaging to the users of, you know, why wouldn't you use us? You know, we'd love to hear the why not rather yeah. than the why. Because we want to make this as easy and frictionless as possible. The logic is that if a restaurant is paying 30% commission to one platform and say 10 or 15% to a different platform, they're going to have lower prices in that second platform. So our pitch to the consumer is very simple. It's you're already ordering food. You care about a charity. The food could potentially be less into your wallet using this platform. It's the same experience, the same restaurants, the same ordering process, the same delivery. Why wouldn't you use it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting market to go to. I guess you mentioned at the beginning that there's kind of this effect of a lot of students might be spending their parents' money, right? Some students are probably saying to themselves, yeah, I don't DoorDash. I order, you know, I get potatoes and rice yeah, from the grocery store.
You know, you get ramen, a couple boxes
yeah,
of ramen
yeah, exactly.
maybe through the week, you know, a exactly. loaf of bread and a peanut, you know, jar of peanut butter and jelly to get you through the week. I get that. And yeah. it's interesting. We also see that from school to school, just the early surveys we've gotten where, you know, some schools that, you know, a huge number, huge percentage of the students are ordering food on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And then some schools, you know, you're seeing students, it's treated more of a luxury, maybe every other week.
But if you have enough users, and I mean, it sounds like adoption or, you know, downloads of the platform is pretty easy to get, maybe,
correct.
Right? You get an ambassador, they bring their friends in, and they download the platform. What kind of use rates are you seeing there?
So the good part is once it's downloaded and once the user is actually on board, we've made it pretty seamless for them to use it. So the only hiccups we see, Jeff, and obviously things we need to address, if we don't have enough coverage in the region, that's the feedback we get from the students. Well, I, you know, some days I order, you know, Chick-fil-A, some days I order Chipotle. If we don't have both, the hard
then
part
they might go to the other platforms that
correct.
Just so they don't have to swap.
Yep, exactly. So we're coming up with, you know, some guardrails that if we're going to launch a certain campus, we have to have a certain percentage overlap with other apps before we launch. you know, the worst case scenario is, you know, Paul tells Jeff, hey, here's this new app, order using this. And then you log on and there's two restaurants.
Yeah. And the seven that I want to order from aren't on there. I could see that being an adoption struggle. So how do you tackle that issue? I mean, is it just a matter of sending ambassadors out to restaurants to get critical mass, or is there some other thing that you're doing? Like, do you leverage in the app, you know, you leverage, oh, we're just going to make we're going to push suggestions for lunch out so that we can suggest restaurants we have on there as opposed to ones that they might be looking for that we don't have.
Yeah. It's right now we're tackling in a couple different ways. The two big ones are obviously the ambassadors. We're basically replicating the model that these larger platforms used early on, where they had, you know, street teams literally walking into the local Burger King, asking to speak to the franchisee.
Yeah.
Walking into the local boba shop place. That works. We send them in with an iPad. It's a very quick process. It takes, like I said, you know, sub 30 minutes for them to sign up, connect their POS system, and very shortly after they're getting new delivery orders.
Yeah.
The other way is from the top down, working with some of the larger restaurant groups. So reaching out to their charity arm, their philanthropy team, and saying, listen, you know, you want more students ordering from you. That's why you have three restaurants within the vicinity of the campus. The students now also want to give back with their order. We can help you combine those two while also charging you less money than these other platforms. So yeah. It's, again, quickly addressing the pain points while all the added bonus of the charity. We've gotten some really great feedback, but working with, you know, a franchise group that has, you know, 1,000 locations, it takes time. You know, you have to prepare for a couple cycles or a couple quarters. But in the meantime, we've also gotten a lot of the franchise information from those groups to say, well, you know, here's Jeff. He owns 15 Checkers restaurants down in the area you're looking. We'll make a quick introduction. Then it's up to Jeff. So yeah. We've seen a lot of, you know, a lot of success reaching out to the, because a lot of these larger corporations have certain budgets to impact the local community in a positive way.
Yeah.
And this, you know, and we're showing them we're supporting the same charity you are. You know, we're seeing that with some local charities that have a national presence. It's, you know, we're actually working with the same exact charity. So the three of us will sometimes get on an email and say, all right, how do we speed this up a little bit?
For the benefit of the charity. Let's get this going.
Correct.
Well, I love the model and I think it's interesting. It'll be, you know, be fun to watch and see as it gets adopted more broadly. How would another CEO who's scaling their own business, whether it's in a similar industry or an unrelated industry, how would they, what would they take away from this discussion today and say, you know, I love that Paul is approaching these issues in a certain way. Here's what I'm going to, you know, here's what I can now apply in my business that I maybe hadn't thought of before. And I know it's context specific, right? If we set up the whole problem, and if you were that CEO coming in with knowing what your problems were, it'd be easier to draw out something. But what are maybe a couple of the general lessons that you think could be leveraged beyond just your own business?
Yeah, I think one could be, you know, focus on really building alignment with you know, before the scale. You know, we had to go out and have conversations with charity people, with restaurant owners, with consumers, delivery companies before we even wrote a line of code. Mm-hmm. Because if we heard from one of them, I don't really align with this mission. I don't believe in it. This won't work. There wasn't a business model. So, yeah. You know, your mission, your partners, your customers, they all have to be pulling kind of in the same direction. They all have to believe in the end result of what you're building. And then growth really becomes a byproduct, not the goal.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we have people call us, you know, how many restaurants are you going to have? How many, you know, well, if there's no cost to the restaurant, if there's no cost, the consumer saving money, the charity, we're removing the friction points. Everybody's rowing in the same direction and wants to reach the same goal. Now it's just a matter of putting all the pieces together. And like I said earlier, making sure as we scale, we're building on the right foundation. Everything's in the right place. You know, it's, I don't want to rush because I don't want, you know, anything to kind of struggle at scale. But as long as everybody's aligned, you know, you have all parts of the business aligned. I think you're in a good spot, regardless of whether it's food delivery or, you know, a cleaning business or, you know, building ships. It's everybody's aligned. You're going to get there.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Trusty validation steps, right? Make sure you validate before you're doing anything else. And that's harder in a marketplace because I've talked to clients who come to me and they're like, I'm going to build this and it's got, you know, a marketplace. And I'm like, just think about, you know, it's not good or bad, but you're kind of building two separate businesses and then putting them together, right? You got to get the consumer side market validated, make sure they'll buy from you. And you got to get the seller side marketplace, in this case, maybe the charities or the restaurants, that they want to be a part of it and make sure that they're going to participate. And then you got to make sure that you can put those two together in a way that everybody's happy. And so you're validating a lot more steps than if you were just, you know, opening up a
restaurant,
a single restaurant, right? Although I don't know, I think a restaurant by itself still might be harder than a marketplace.
Correct. Yeah, and that was kind of, you know, also what motivates you, because as you validate the sides, you know, every side's going to add multiple layers of complexity. So that clarity on, hey, we believe in this. You know, I spoke to probably 50 restaurant owners. I probably spoke to 100 college students. I probably spoke to 10 huge national charity, you know, the biggest charities out there. Mm-hmm. And they all said, I get it. Like, huh, so, you know, we want to be involved.
Yeah.
So to hear that validation, it motivates you. It's like, all right, there's something here. I know it's going to be a long slog. It's going to take a long time to build this and, you know, get to scale. But, you know, we validated the pieces. We iterated over time, obviously. But, you know, all three major components of the business were like, we like this. We want to be a part of it. You know, how do we get involved?
Yeah. I guess it's natural that we're coming back to what we started with, that aspect of making sure there is alignment, because alignment scales well and misalignment also scales easily. So back to that same point, validating that everything is there so that it is aligned and will scale well instead of scale the misalignment. So
yeah, growth will only amplify the cracks, right?
It's yeah. Yeah. Well, this is great, Paul. I really appreciate you sharing some of this with us. And I know there's a lot more to it. And we've got, you know, some things to watch as you grow. Where do you think you'll be in 5 years from now?
Hopefully, you know, people are saying, hey, you know, I used Goodbye to order my corporate meal, the Sunday lunch with the family. You know, I think we want it to be kind of synonymous with, you know, ordering food and doing well. I think there's going to be, you know, an opportunity to introduce this into other things like food delivery, like you mentioned earlier, like grocery delivery.
Yeah, yeah.
Different things where, you know, there's a tremendous margin in between what consumers are paying and what these platforms are making. You know, if we could put some of that back into the business and also take part of that and give it off to charity, I think it's a win for everybody. And, you know, I think this next generation also wants to buy from and be a part of companies and organizations that are about doing good. So that's where we're going to be in 5 years. We're hopefully upset some of these giants.
I love it. Two more questions and then we'll call it a wrap here. But first of all, if a student is out there, wants to be a part of this, or if a restaurant hears about this, where would they go to connect with you?
Yeah, they could check us out at goodbite.charity. So that's, you know, our homepage for the all things Goodbite. There's places there if you're a restaurant, a charity, a student, and you want to get involved.
Awesome. And last question here, since we're talking about charities, it doesn't have a whole lot to do with your business other than you're supporting a bunch of charities through the business model. But do you have a favorite charity that you'd plug on this if you had just a minute?
Yeah, two of them. One is, you know, Alzheimer's Foundation. My mom unfortunately suffers from Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. It's been a brutal time seeing her go through this, you know, and live with this disease. And then ASPCA, we're a very big pet household. You know, I love to see, you know, people adopting rather than buying. And, you know, I think every kid, every house needs a pet. I think it helps the kids develop a lot of skills, a lot of life skills, empathy, responsibility. So those are two. Yeah. When I order Goodbite, I'll probably toggle between those two charities and hopefully have an impact.
I love it. Sorry to hear about your mother. That's what a wonderful cause to support, though.
Thank you. So,
well, Paul, it's been a pleasure having you on the show today, and I really appreciate you taking some time to share about your business and the insights that you've learned and leveraged in your business.
Awesome, a lot of fun, Jeff. Appreciate the time, and have a great day. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been great. And to all of our listeners out there, thanks again for joining us this time on the Breakout CEO Podcast.
Be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And if you enjoy the show, a rating or a review goes a long way. Our mission is to promote the stories of breakout CEOs in scaling SaaS, e-commerce, and tech companies to equip peer CEOs with valuable perspectives and confidence. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Breakout CEO. I'm Jeff Holman, and I'll see you next time.